the new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
I began researching the case against Karen Reed in the summer of 2023. It interested me because I thought it seemed like a simple case, but somehow there's talk of a potential conspiracy. I wanted to dive in and look at all of the evidence, weigh it out, and find out if that could be true. I had no idea when I got involved just how crazy all of this would get. Over the last 2 years, I have watched this case become increasingly more popular as it progressed through the legal system. Each pretrial hearing would bring up new accusations and elements of mystery. Missing video footage. Revelations that the lead investigator had connections to the people involved. Witnesses destroying phones. And an FBI investigation that was running parallel to a state prosecution, which pretty much never happens. With each new piece of evidence, new questions arose, and a small story in the local news slowly began gaining national and international attention. Social media further amplified the case's reach, launching an entire Free Karen Reed movement, where passionate supporters, united by the belief in Karen's innocence, hold public demonstrations and advocate for her release. For 8 weeks, supporters have gathered outside of the Norfolk County Courthouse in Dedham, Massachusetts, carrying signs, wearing pink, and cheering as Karen Reed and her attorneys make their way to the courtroom. With millions of people all over the globe watching, it's hard to believe that this case may finally be coming to an end. It's the final week of trial number two, and inside the courtroom, it was an ongoing battle of the experts as the defense called their final witnesses to close out their case in chief. The jury heard from Brown University professor and former chief medical examiner for Rhode Island, Dr. Elizabeth LaPosada, and, of course, the ARCA experts, forensic scientist and accident reconstructionist Dr. Daniel Wolf, and senior biomechanist Dr. Andrew Rentschler. Let's start with Dr. LaPosada. Before she even got to testify, the Commonwealth filed motions to try to limit the things that she'd be able to talk about on the stand. Enter another voir dire. As a note, the Commonwealth hasn't had a single witness that's had to do a voir dire, but I digress. So in her voir dire, we learned that Dr. LaPosada is a board-certified forensic pathologist and has performed over 3,000 autopsies. She has testified in federal court on a pattern recognition with dogs, and even teaches medical school classes on it. And despite all of that, Judge Ganoni still denied Dr. LaPasada to be able to testify about dog bites. Now, once she actually took the stand, the defense began with some basics, like her background, her experience with wound pattern recognition, and how many autopsies she's performed in her career. Then the defense began to focus on John O'Keefe. Dr. LaPasada said the small cut above John O'Keefe's eye could not have come from that wind wing or spoiler on Karen Reed's car. She said if that had hit him, there would be a ribbon of bruising, something that was not present at the time of John's autopsy. She also talked about the injury on the back of John O'Keefe's skull. She said that the laceration looks like he hit his head on something with a ridge because of its irregularity. AJ asked, the type of ridge that's in a garage? Brennan was quick to object, and Judge Canoni told the jury to ignore it. Interestingly, Dr. LaPasada went on to explain that falling back and hitting your head wouldn't cause the injury that John O'Keefe had. She said that that would cause more of a star-like injury, not linear. If he had hit his head falling backwards, like onto grass, there would be grass in the wound, and it would present as a crisscross pattern. And none of that was there either. But what about hypothermia? Dr. LaPasada said that she believes the machine that does chest compressions in the ambulance and at the hospital is what caused the hemorrhaging on John O'Keefe's stomach, not hypothermia. In fact, she didn't think he had hypothermia at all. Her medical opinion is that John O'Keefe died from brain injuries and skull fractures due to blunt force trauma of the head, and that he was already dead by the time his body began to cool. This opinion would line up with the defense's theory that John was killed or died somewhere else and then moved to the yard. And the injuries to John's arm? Well, according to Dr. LaPasada, those are consistent with animal bites or claw marks and were not caused by a motor vehicle impact. Despite all of this testimony, Jackson was sitting on one shocking piece of evidence that we have never seen before. An X-ray of John O'Keefe's arm. And what did it show? No broken bones, not one. On cross, it was quite clear that Dr. LaPasada not only knew her stuff, but that she's pretty unshakable too. She corrected Hank on a lot of stuff with zero hesitation. And Hank tried to use some negative publicity that Dr. LaPasada received while she was the chief ME for Rhode Island in relation to a backlog of autopsy reports from a large fire. But Dr. LaPasada was quick to shut this claim down and said the whole thing was basically BS. Overall, she was easy to follow, firm in her conclusions, and seemed like a really strong witness for the defense. While there have been some key witnesses and testimony for the defense, I believe that ARCA may be the most important because their testimony provides the defense with an argument based in science that the evidence doesn't support the prosecution's claims. And what better way to show reasonable doubt to a jury? We learned that the jurors from the last trial kind of dismissed ARCA's testimony because they thought that it was an insurance company who hired them or someone else with an ulterior motive. They weren't allowed to know that it was the federal government. Jackson made sure that the jury didn't confuse this again. On redirect, he let them know that it was a third-party agency, but not an insurance agency. Something that stood out to me is also the amount that ARCA was paid versus the amount that Aperture was paid. We know that Aperture was paid almost $400,000 for the blue paint testing and other analysis and PowerPoint, but he didn't actually do any testing. ARCA did a ton of testing for this trial, and we found out that they were only paid $50,000 for that. That blew my mind. But maybe finding experts that say what you need them to say gets expensive. Which brings me to my next point. Aside from the impressive high-profile clients and projects, ARCA being an independent third party is one of the factors that gives their conclusions the most credibility. So, of course, it's one of the factors that Brennan did his best to try to discredit, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, let's talk about the impact of their conclusions and testing for the defense's case. Their initial testing began late 2023 into early 2024, and they were given an open-ended question. Does the damage to the car line up to the injuries in any way? We've all heard about the cannon they built. The purpose of that pneumatic customized cannon was to simulate throwing a cocktail glass at the taillight to see if it could have caused the damage. And they found that at 37 miles per hour, it was generally consistent. The glass broke the outer lens as well as the inside diffuser. Per the baseball expert, the average untrained male throwing speed ranges from 45 to 65 miles per hour. Now, they also did testing to determine if the damage and injuries could have come from contact with the head to the taillight, so they performed a drop test with a crash dummy. And the damage to the car was significantly more than Karen Reed's, but it still didn't have enough force to cause the skull fracture. So this test proved that it's inconsistent with the head making contact with the taillight. We'll be right back after this. Now, they also did testing to determine if the arm could have made an impact with the taillight, and they determined that that was also inconsistent because the damage to the car and the arm would have been much more significant if there was an impact that had enough force to break the taillight. Out of all three of these, the only one that was consistent with breaking the taillight was the cocktail glass, and that's because they have the heavy bottom hitting it with enough force, meaning technically, if something else heavy hit it with enough force, like a hammer or a flashlight, that could also be consistent. I've always wondered about the extra glass on the bumper that didn't match the cocktail glass. If the defense's theory was right and that taillight was busted out, could that have come from the glass of a flashlight? Another part of this case that we'll probably never have an answer to. And then we have the new testing from ARCA, where they were brought back by the defense specifically to look at Welcher's opinions and how he got there. Methodology, experiments, data analysis, things like that. They noted a few issues with Welcher's testing. For example, he called the injuries to John O'Keefe's arm lacerations, but they are actually superficial abrasions, according to all the medical professionals in the case. Welcher's PowerPoint said the location and orientation of the lacerations on his arm are consistent with geometry and orientation of the right rear taillight. And Brennan must have got his feelings hurt when Dr. Rentschler pointed out that Welcher was wrong here, because he got pretty snarky with him about it.
Well, you talk about x-rays and injury. I know you don't make medical diagnosis, but you were very careful to be detailed about what this was. Not a laceration, right? It is a superficial abrasion.
But calling the injuries lacerations isn't the only issue on that slide. The location and orientation of the injuries doesn't actually line up in geometry or orientation to the taillight. Dr. Rentschler explained that you can't really say it lines up with any scientific certainty because they didn't do any measurements, they just kind of eyeballed it. And when the arm is bent, the direction of the abrasions are actually not consistent with how he held his arm because they go in different directions. Aside from some of those issues, Dr. Wolf also says that Dr. Welcher's static test, where neither car nor person are moving, has no scientific purpose. The only thing it demonstrates is that you can get your arm to align with the taillight. So ARCA did some testing to answer all of the questions that Welcher didn't answer. They bought an exemplar car and controlled as many variables as possible, including using a freezer for taillight temperature control and the same hoodie as John to see if they could get any of their testing results from impact to show damage to the sleeve like John's. They did three types of testing, one using a linear impactor, one using an arm suspended from a forklift as the car backed into it, and one using a rescue Randy with the car backing into him. They positioned the dummy arm the same way that Welcher was standing to test what damage and injuries would occur if things happened the way that Welcher said they did. Now, there were no tests that caused any kind of punctures in the hoodie sleeve. And as far as the taillight goes, Dr. Wolf explained the taillight is 5 millimeters of thick red plastic. Then there's about 1.5 inches of space, and then the diffusers, which light up. All of that was shattered on Karen Reed's car. And they brought a huge taillight to show the jury. It was a great visual representation, and with diffusers being broken in that way, it shows that there had to be a lot of force. The 24 mile per hour test didn't even break the diffusers in that way. And the 29 mile per hour test did so much damage that it actually shattered the taillight along with the back window, the lift gate crushed in, the bumper step popped out, and they still didn't have the diffusers broken. So while 24-mile-per-hour testing didn't do enough damage to the taillight, Dr. Rentschler explains that John's hand and arm would have broken bones at only 15 miles per hour, and potentially, depending on how it hits, at only 10 miles per hour. So there's no way that John's arm could have been positioned the way that Welcher said it was. This became a big issue during Dr. Rentschler's cross, because suddenly, I guess now that it's been debunked, Hank Brennan is very angry that the ARCA experts took it upon themselves to just assume that the only test that Welcher did to show the position of John's arm apparently has nothing to do with where Welcher thought John's arm was. Take a listen to some of the highlights from this exchange.
You don't have any information that Dr. Welcher ever claimed that his test was intended to represent exactly how Mr. O'Keefe's arm was when he was hit, do you?
Well, the evidence I have for that is that in his report, he says that the orientation and position of the lacerations are consistent with the orientation position of the taillight cover. And then right under that, he has reference to that test that he performed.
Let's get back to my question. Your assumption that Dr. Welcher was suggesting that there was a specific arm angle that occurred in this case that he was identifying. You don't see that anywhere in his report.
Well, it would be pretty odd if the one test he ran didn't actually represent what he thought happened. I don't understand what the value of that would actually be. He said, I have conducted an accident reconstruction and biomechanical engineering analysis of this matter. If he did not recreate how he was positioned, if he did not determine the speed of impact, if he did not determine how Mr. O'Keefe's body moved, if he did not determine where he ended up, then he did not conduct either an accident reconstruction analysis or a biomechanical causation analysis. He did nothing of the sort.
Other than your opinion, let's get back to my question if I could.
I believe I answered at the beginning of that, sir.
I'm going to ask you again. My detailed question is, there is nothing in Dr. Welcher's report that states he is trying to represent the exact posture, movement, and stance of Mr. O'Keefe when there was a collision. It's not anywhere in there where he stated that, is it?
It's not stated. I'd be curious to find out if that wasn't the intent of the test, I'd be curious to see what the actual intent was.
Is the answer no, it's not in there?
I think I just said that at the beginning of my answer, sir.
I'm going to ask you again. Is the answer no?
The answer is no.
Brennan's anger and attitude get much worse. But before we get to that, I want to go over highlights from each of the ARCA experts' testimony and cross. First, Dr. Wolf and the damage to the car. Dr. Wolf has a PowerPoint that goes over fundamental scientific equations and laws of physics, trying to help break it all down for the jury. Dr. Wolf's direct testimony was flooded with objections by Hank Brennan, and pretty much every single one was sustained. But he was finally able to give his conclusions to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the damage to the car is inconsistent with the impact of an arm, even in a sideswipe or clipping situation. When cross began, Hank Brennan came out incredibly aggressive. Jackson had asked Dr. Wolf what kind of contracts ARCA normally engages in, and he said, going back in time, they have dealt with contracts with the Department of Defense designing energy-absorbing seats to help armed forces when driving over IEDs. He also said that they have done work with the NHL, among other things. Dr. Wolf specified that the Department of Defense contract was an example going back in time. But when Hank Brennan started his cross, the first thing he did was get up and turn that into a big deal.
The work with the Department of Defense, was that during your time or before you got there?
That would have been prior to my employment, yes.
So when you were telling them about working with the Department of Defense, that really had nothing to do with you. That was ARCA before you began working there.
ARCA as a whole, yes, the work that we do, yes.
Not you.
But Hank didn't get the chance to pull that same stunt with Dr. Rentschler.
We've worked in the past with the United States military. I helped design what we call the energy-absorbing seat for the MRAP vehicles.
Brennan also did something here that I thought was incredibly unethical. He wanted to paint these experts as hired guns who can't be trusted. So he made some insinuations that he knew that the defense wouldn't be able to clear up for the jury. This frustrates me because I expect the prosecutor to want to tell the whole truth. They're held to a higher standard. The amount of misleading that Hank Brennan has done over the course of this case is infuriating to me. Brennan badgered each of the ARCA experts about violating the sequestration order for this case. Now, if the jury were allowed to know the truth, they would know that it was the FBI who was communicating with them. The feds are the ones that they're working for, so they assumed that when the FBI was telling them something, the FBI is going to know what that violation is and what it isn't. But Brennan makes these accusations, forcing the experts to say that they violated the sequestration order, while the judge still won't allow the defense to tell the jury the truth about what that means. This is the kind of behavior that just makes me sick to my stomach. Truth and transparency be damned. Brennan also brings up Signal, asking Dr. Wolf if he had ever used it before, and he said no. He asked if he had used it since, and Dr. Wolf said not yet. He also brings up the text thread that Dr. Wolf deleted with Jackson months after the trial ended, insinuating that he had something to hide. Brennan had a sour attitude the entire time, and when Dr. Wolf finished answering one of his questions, Hank, who acted completely uninterested, said, "You done?" Then brought up an email from Dr. Wolf to Jackson, letting him know that he misunderstood one of the questions during voir dire, where he was asked how many times he had been qualified as an expert to testify. Dr. Wolf said that he had answered 20, which included court and depositions. But he said the question was, I guess, specifically for court, and that answer would be 11. Brennan begins a line of questioning about this, and even though Jackson objects, somehow the judge allows it.
If you make a mistake in court under oath, would you take the affirmative step on your own and correct that mistake?
Objection. I'll allow it.
I would do my best to do that, yes.
Well, when you say do your best, would you do that if you became aware of it?
Objection. I'm going to allow it.
Yes.
Did you clarify and fix the mistaken testimony that you had provided just days earlier?
I don't recall being asked a question, no.
It wasn't whether you're being asked. The question is, did you take the affirmative step to fix the misstatements under oath that you made?
Objection. I'm going to allow it.
The reason that Judge Cannone should not have allowed this questioning is because Brennan is insinuating to the jury that there's something that Dr. Wolf did that was unethical or said something wrong, and he's insinuating that Dr. Wolf could have done something to correct the record. Dr. Wolf is not in charge of what questions Jackson asks him. Remember when Maureen Hartnett said that she wanted to correct the record with something, and she was told no? But Judge Cannone allows Brennan to once again mislead this jury. It is wild to me. Wild. Pretty much everything that Brennan attacked Dr. Wolf on during voir dire, he also attacked him on during cross, so I won't get back into all of it. But this time, he took it a step further.
Do you have any close family that supports one side over the other? Not the facts or the data, but one side over the other.
Close family?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Wife?
My wife?
Yes.
I don't really know what her thoughts are on the case.
After the last trial, Dr. Wolf was receiving a lot of attention. His wife was sent a link to a Facebook group to see what was being said, and she joined the group. The date that she joined shows that it was after his testimony. The very few comments that she made were the typical comments that you would expect to see from a wife who's proud of her husband. And not a single one of them was about Karen Reed or the case, only her husband. She then became viciously harassed from the hateful internet trolls who basically harass all of us on a daily basis. They even posted pictures of her children online. She said that something she originally thought was so cute and fun quickly became very scary. She left the Facebook group and locked down her social media, all because she was a proud wife. I guess no low is too low for Brennan here. Brennan also spends a lengthy amount of time badgering Dr. Wolf about using an ATD crash dummy, and Dr. Wolf continues to explain that the dummy is accepted in testing, and Dr. Rentschler will be the one testifying about the injuries. over and over. About a half hour in, Brennan seems to be completely out of control with his behavior.
The use of that device is certainly generally accepted.
When you get uncomfortable with my question, you generally tend to answer a different question.
Sustain, Mr. Brennan, next question.
Oh, that's a strike.
Strike that, Jules.
Let me ask you again. Don't you think, as an expert, that you study the basis for that opinion before you give it?
Yes.
As Brennan is asking Dr. Wolf about different variables, Dr. Wolf says that knowing the body position in a case like this isn't really helpful and it doesn't really matter because impact position and point of rest aren't applicable here because the damage to the car wasn't consistent with the collision. Brennan again badgers Dr. Wolf about this, and the judge again allows it. Here's the first time that he answers this.
And you would want to know, if you could, the body posture, whether the person was standing up straight, they had their arm out. That's helpful information, isn't it?
It can be, but when we're talking about how quickly this impact duration is, right? If we're talking about a 10 millisecond window, so however the body is positioned at contact, that's how it's positioned. It's not going to be able to have any significant movement or change in orientation in that 10 millisecond window.
Here's Dr. Wolf answering it the second time.
You don't know the exact body position. That creates variables in your studies, doesn't it?
Again, talking about those studies, they're not applicable when you are contacting, for instance, just a limb or you don't have a center of gravity hit.
Here's the third time.
You would not want to know the body position?
I don't think that it would be helpful in determining, because again, we have to start with, does the damage, is it consistent with a collision?
And here's the fourth time.
So you would not want to know the body position. That's what you're telling us. You don't want to know that.
Well, if the evidence indicates that the contact is inconsistent, then that's kind of where the reconstruction stops.
By the fifth time, Jackson objects. Dr. Wolf doesn't even understand what Brennan is asking anymore because he's explained it so many times. And Judge Cannone doesn't do much to help the situation.
So you don't want to know the body position.
Objection.
Can you answer that?
I don't understand his question, Your Honor.
So Brennan asks a sixth time.
When you're doing studies, you don't want to know the body position?
Objection.
Can you answer that, Dr. Wolf?
Again, it depends on the type of impact. For the alleged contact in this case, you can't rely on those studies about impact location and point of rest. They're not applicable to this.
I was talking about studies.
Brennan literally asked the question about studies and then says he's not talking about studies, but okay. So Brennan continues to badger him over a question that he's answered like five or six times now, after explaining it already another time. So Brennan asks a seventh time, and Judge Cannone's response to Jackson's objection shouldn't have shocked me, but it did.
Would you want to know the body positioning?
Objection. This is 5 times.
And this time we'll get an answer and that'll be it.
You've got an answer every single time.
Can you answer that, Dr. Wolf?
I feel like I've answered it the best I can, Your Honor.
Okay, next question.
You don't like that question?
Objection.
Sustained.
Strike.
Jurors disregard.
Okay.
I know that that's hard to hear because the audio is terrible when they're not near the microphones, but Jackson's objecting. And the judge overrules it again, and Jackson finally says, look, he's asked him this now 5 times. And by the way, he's answered it every single time. And the judge says, well, maybe we'll get an answer this time. How rude is that? And also, is she not paying attention? And then when Brennan makes his smart comments and is so disrespectful, she's just so nonchalant about it. I don't understand how this is allowed. Brennan continued this behavior, and this podcast isn't even long enough to play all of the clips for you to hear. And Judge Cannone doesn't help at all. She overrules almost every single one of Jackson's objections. There's one point where Brennan isn't even asking a question. He's just making a long, aggressive statement. And Jackson objects, and she even allows that one. Brennan spends a lot of time talking about the size of the dummy arm. And Dr. Wolf continues over and over to explain that the arm weight difference doesn't matter in terms of his portion of the testing, since the full mass of the arm isn't coming into contact with the car. But Brennan continued to badger him about not using the larger arm. at which point Dr. Wolf points out that Welcher used the same one. Brennan also argued that the holes in the hoodie after the 29-mile-per-hour test are similar to the ones in John O'Keefe's sleeve. But he explained those aren't similar. The holes in the dummy's hoodie were from road rash, and they were on the opposite arm. There was also road rash all over his body, his nose, and the rest of his shirt was mangled. It wasn't similar at all. Now, during the second cross-examination that Brennan did of Dr. Wolf, Hank brought up the hoodie again, and this time, he had it in the plexiglass behind the stand ready to bring out. The proper procedure is to show the opposing counsel before you do anything like that, and Brennan didn't. He showed the hoodie to Dr. Wolf and then began asking about the holes in the back of the hoodie. Dr. Wolf begins to explain that he knows about the cuttings in the back of the hoodie, but Brennan cuts him off. He asks the judge to approach and then begins questioning him.
When you were making that opinion about consistent or inconsistent, did you ever consider whether there were holes in Mr. O'Keefe's sweatshirt other than the right arm?
Well, I know that there was cutting to the...
May I approach and retrieve the exhibit, John?
Yes.
Did you ever look at the back of the sweatshirt to see if there was any holes to the back of the sweatshirt other than the right arm when you formed your opinion?
I don't recall.
Take a look at the back. Do you see other holes on the back of Mr. O'Keefe's sweatshirt?
This misrepresentation led to a little bit of chaos because those holes were cut by Maureen Hartnett, the criminalist. And everybody knows that. There's even photos that are taken of the back of John's shirt that show that there's no damage to it. And Hank Brennan is using this right now in front of the jury, trying to make it look like Dr. Wolf didn't do his job properly. And there are holes in the back of John O'Keefe's shirt, and it does match up to the one in the dummy test. The defense points this out, and they ask for a mistrial, which, of course, is denied. The judge says she'll give a curative instruction, but the instruction that she gave wasn't curative at all. All she said was, "I instruct you that these holes came from Maureen Hartnett." But Jackson got the last word in that because he even brought that up in closing arguments, pointing out to the jury that Hank Brennan completely misled them. And he even said, "I bet he won't bring it up," in his closings. And he didn't. I wonder if that made them think about what else Hank Brennan has misled them on. He's pretty much allowed to get away with everything. There are no consequences for anything that he does. Now let's talk a little bit about Dr. Rentschler's testimony, which is focused on the injuries to John O'Keefe. He mentioned the x-rays, the ones that we thought didn't exist because of Welcher. Brennan asked when he first got them. He said he got them when he first looked at this case. Dr. Rentschler said that he saw the x-rays and there's no indication of any kind of acute injury to John O'Keefe's hand, forearm, upper arm, and there's no signs of trauma. Also, he said the sleeve doesn't line up to the abrasions. There were 36 wounds on the arm and only 9 punctures in that hoodie sleeve. I thought that was interesting. He also points out that during Welcher's test, he actually kind of rolls into that light. So it wasn't even really an accurate test at all. And he says it's not scientific. He also talks about the Commonwealth's theory that John O'Keefe ended up in the yard. He says it's simple physics. The center mass of the body won't move if you're hit on the arm. The arm will be accelerated up and pushed forward away from the body, so there will be stress on the joints and rip the arm forward at the elbow and shoulder joint. So you would see that trauma, but your body wouldn't move. And when you're looking at the injuries, if John O'Keefe's arm hit that car at 24 miles an hour and there's only abrasions, that means that if the taillight didn't shatter, there would be no damage at all with an impact of 24 miles an hour. And that doesn't make any sense. He gives his opinion, reasonable degree of medical certainty, that it is not consistent with striking a taillight cover. Something else that was really interesting here, he talked about the hand. He looked at the hand position during Welcher's test where he was holding the glass. He says there would have been fractures on his hand with that much pressure hitting him. He points out the fact that the hand is actually curved because it's holding a glass. It's not flat. So that whole distributed load that Welcher was talking about doesn't apply here. That car impact would have hit bones in his hand and broken them. And he also points out that those articles and references that Welcher used, out of 26 of them, the most recent one was still more than 20 years old. And most of them were from the 60s and 70s. That's his research. Also, the 1979 article on head injuries, he said the first SUV-type car wasn't even produced until 1984, so you can't use an article from 5 years before that. None of it's accurate. By the time we got to cross-examination on Dr. Rentschler, I think that Hank Brennan was pretty much spiraling, and his behavior was out of control. He's yelling, saying, "Facts matter." He says he's repeating what Dr. Rentschler said multiple times in testing, but it's kind of ironic because he's talking about facts matter, and Dr. Rentschler says, well, it was actually details matter. That's what I kept saying. Ironic detail to miss. Brennan then began badgering Dr. Rentschler about the feds giving him information and whether or not it helped him, and despite objections, Judge Cannone allowed it to continue on and on and on.
Would you agree it certainly helped you prepare?
It helped me prepare?
Yes.
It didn't make a difference to my analysis or conclusions.
I'm not going to play Dr. Rentschler's answers every single time because he keeps answering that nothing helped him with his science and figures. But I want you to hear how many times Hank Brennan keeps asking this. Here's the second time.
Made no difference at all?
It did not, no sir.
And again.
Would you agree it helped you understand what was going on during the trial?
And again.
And so as you sit here today, you are denying that that information certainly helped you prepare.
How did it help me prepare? It didn't change the opinions I offered. It didn't change what was in my report.
And he keeps going.
I'm going to ask you a very specific question, and I want you to give me a very specific
objection.
So just go ahead and ask the question.
Are you denying that receiving that information certainly helped you prepare?
Honestly, I can't remember. It didn't change my opinion. I don't see how it would help me prepare.
And again.
Are you denying that receiving that information certainly helped you prepare? Are you denying it?
Objection. I'm going to allow it.
Yeah, I don't think that it did. It's been a year, but certainly it didn't change any of my opinions or what I opined to. It didn't change anything with my testimony.
And again.
I'm going to ask you one more time. I'll ask you a different question. Receiving that information from your employer, are you denying it helped you understand what was going on during the trial?
I'm going to allow that.
I don't even think that it did. I don't understand that.
All of that badgering for this moment.
Were you asked, and by calling and raising issues and telling you information, even if you weren't requesting it, it helped prepare you for your trial testimony, didn't it? What did you swear?
I said it certainly helped prepare me to understand what was going on during the trial, yes.
All of that was over being told that there was trace DNA on the taillight. And he even said in the first trial, it didn't make any difference in his testing, which is the same thing that he says now. The only difference it made, he said that it helped him understand what is going on in the trial, as in, this is part of their theory, but it didn't change anything. Hank Brennan just badgered him over and over and over for a gotcha moment that completely fell flat. What was the point of that? There were other pointless arguments that came across as desperate, like Brennan bringing up Dr. Rentschler going to the lunch after he testified in the last trial while he waited for his ride. He made a huge deal about Rentschler's ham sandwich.
And how long were you at the table eating your ham sandwich?
I honestly don't know. 10 minutes? How long does it take you to eat a ham sandwich? 10 minutes?
And after you finished your ham sandwich and then you told us you stood in the corner, you got a ride back to the airport?
I did, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Brennan then spent some time trying to question Dr. Rentschler about how much ARCA was paid, but he keeps explaining that he's a salaried employee, so he wouldn't know. He moves on to asking about texts and the Signal app, and Judge Cannone even allows a line of questioning where Hank is asking Dr. Rentschler about Dr. Wolf using Signal. I have no idea how that's allowed, but yet, here we are. Brennan goes through questioning, asking about seeing pedestrians hit and having different injuries from the same speed and car, and once again, repeats the question over and over and over while Jackson objects and the judge allows it. Brennan asked Dr. Rentschler if he's aware that most of John's injuries are on the right side. And Dr. Rentschler points out that the arm abrasions and the half centimeter abrasion on his knee are on the right side, but the laceration and scuff on his face are actually on the left side, and the head injury is in the back. He tries to elicit medical testimony from Dr. Rentschler. Dr. Rentschler tells him he doesn't give diagnosis. Brennan gets snappy with him about him talking about some of the medical diagnosis, and he points out all of that is in the medical reports.
So when you were giving all that information to the jury about the x-rays, was that your personal opinion, or were you just regurgitating something you had read?
That was the medical examiner's opinion, but certainly you can look at the x-rays and see that there are no actual fracture lines or space displacement between the joints.
This behavior continues. In fact, here's a highlight reel of Cranky Hank.
No, it wasn't about 10 pounds. It was less than 10 pounds. Let's be exact. You're a scientist. You're a scientist, right? You can think. I'm asking you just a general question over here. So you were comfortable just coming in with no experience in this whatsoever, without even studying or doing any research. You were comfortable to come in and just throw out an opinion?
Put aside your story about the force perspective. My specific question is, it's
sustained.
So when you were looking up the x-ray and holding it up, was that just a prop? I mean, were you simply just regurgitating what you read in the report, or were you doing a certain
sustained
kind of... Sustained. So you're regurgitating what's in the report.
Sustained enough.
Well, again, Dr. Rentschler is going to be addressing the... You're shaking your head.
So I'm going to let him answer the question.
You have no idea where the point of impact was in this collision, do you?
Nobody does.
I'm asking you, not nobody.
Yeah, I...
You, excuse me.
So let go ahead and ask the
you,
question.
Dr. Rentschler, before this jury, have no idea where the point of impact was of this collision, do you?
That's correct. There's no evidence.
You don't like that question either?
Objection.
Sustained.
I won't ask you again, but if you can answer this once for me, do you have one paper, one objection study?
So I'll take out the commentary.
It was something that is curious or foreign to you, right?
Objection.
Sustained.
Are you confused? I'm Dr. Welcher, I'm asking you.
Objection.
No, it's not.
Okay, so jurors, disregard that exchange between counsel. Next question.
Since your memory is difficult.
Objection.
Sustained. Okay.
Jackson has finally had enough and he asked to approach. But does that stop him? No.
Was there any discussion on how you could portray yourself as independent?
I don't believe there was.
So you don't believe?
Yeah, there was no need to.
That's not the question. Details matter. Was there any attempt?
So the objection sustained. I'm going to strike that, folks. Questions, Mr. Brennan?
He even talks over the judge.
Ask a question. No more
questions. My question is, I want you to be detailed. I don't want you to guess.
So without that go ahead and just ask the question.
You're sidestepping my question.
Objection.
Sustained. Ask a question, Mr. Brennan. Just ask a question. No more
My comments. Question is... You can't delete something that's under oath, right?
Objection.
Sustained.
And so when you feigned confusion on Friday about
Objection.
This 11 pounds...
Objection.
Sustained.
I didn't do that calculation,
I didn't ask you. I'm asking if you would agree with that.
Objection.
So ask the question.
I don't know how many times Brennan has to be told to stop making these comments.
I think, again, you're getting confused between my role and Dr. Rentschler. Can I finish, please?
No. Objection.
Okay. So,
no
comment, Mr. Brennan.
At one point, Jackson objects and he tells the judge this is exactly why they had to approach before.
Well, I didn't ask you that. Is that funny?
No, it's not funny.
Okay.
So, I'm going to strike the comment. Next question. Next question, Mr. Brennan. No more comments.
Of course, that doesn't stop him because Brennan never has any kind of accountability for his behavior. So the next time it happens, Jackson asks the judge to admonish him again.
Now that you've shared your opinions, can I get back to my question?
Sustained. So, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Brent, I'm going to see counsel at sidebar.
The craziest part of that is that she immediately says Mr. Jackson instead of even getting on to Brennan. That's why he keeps doing it. Because he can. It gives me grave concerns. At some point, Dr. Rentschler got tired of being disrespected and started clapping back a little bit.
That wasn't done in this case, was it?
What? It wasn't. It wasn't necessary.
Was that done in this case?
It wasn't. I'll speak slower and a little clearer.
Then if you answer my question.
I just did answer it. I said it wasn't.
And in the end, Dr. Rentschler stuck to his conclusions. He doesn't think that there was a car accident at all.
If you can't prove that the impact happened, then everything after that doesn't actually matter, does it? Because all that would be from something else. So unless you prove the core issue at this case, the contact, the post-impact movement, the head injury, without proving that, everything else is ancillary to what you're attempting to conclude.
We'll be right back after this. Something else kind of outrageous that Brennan did is ask Dr. Rentschler this question.
Did you consider or know that there was evidence that a piece of glass or a piece of broken plastic was pulled from Mr. O'Keefe's nose?
Objection.
I'm going to allow that.
There's nothing in evidence that says anything about a piece of broken plastic being pulled from John O'Keefe's nose. Brennan has completely made that up. Jackson objects, and the judge is going to allow it. This is outrageous.
I'm going to allow that.
You are.
So, hold on.
Sure.
Let's get an answer, Dr. Mitchell. Your objection's noted, Mr. Jackson.
I was aware there was some piece of material allegedly pulled from the nose, yes.
Allegedly pulled from the nose?
Yes.
Okay. And that alleged piece of material, were you aware that it was perhaps a piece of glass or broken plastic?
Objection.
Jackson objects again and tells the judge this is not in evidence.
Are you aware of that?
No, that's not in evidence. That is not in evidence.
So?
Glass?
Hold on, Mr. Jackson. Mr. Brennan.
I can reword it.
This is a huge problem for a couple of reasons. One, there's no evidence of this. It was only a statement in the documentary about pulling a piece of glass out of the nose. And two, never has anyone said that it was a piece of plastic in John's nose. That is so misleading. And it is crazy that Jackson is objecting to this and the judge is allowing it. I think that all of these comments can truly backfire. Brennan's used to being a defense attorney, and defense attorneys have a different standard than prosecutors. He is the prosecutor in this case, not the defense attorney. All of these comments that he knows he's not supposed to make, that can be a problem. Being admonished by the judge and having all of these times that she's told him to stop making comments and he's still doing it when he knows it's wrong, at what point does that start impacting a fair trial? At what point does that become prosecutorial misconduct? His behavior could potentially jeopardize a guilty verdict if he's able to get one. His behavior could turn into an appellate issue. And the fact that the judge is allowing it, that makes it even worse. But no matter how much Hank Brennan tried to discredit ARCA, he couldn't. Their testimony was strong, and they had science and data to back it all up. No amount of insults or ham sandwiches can really negate that. The defense team called each of the 11 witnesses in their case for a specific purpose. These last three expert witnesses were called to put the final pieces of the defense's case together for the jury. Each of them played a pivotal role in challenging the prosecution's narrative while shaping the jury's understanding of why the prosecution's case is so flawed. And with that, the defense rested. Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan has never been happy about ARCA's testimony. He actually sought to introduce rebuttal witnesses, particularly bringing Dr. Judd Welcher back to counter the testing and conclusions of ARCA. He also planned to call Terry Coon to introduce the dog DNA evidence, and he said he was recalling criminalist Maureen Hartnett. Motions were filed about this, the defense filed an opposition, and the judge ruled in favor of the prosecution again. But in a surprising twist, Brennan told the judge after the defense rested that he doesn't intend to call any more witnesses after all. I can't help but wonder if this was a calculated move. Keep ongoing litigation over this to keep the defense busy and distracted. Or maybe he didn't want to bring Welcher back because that would open him up to cross-examination over those x-rays. Or maybe Welcher didn't want to come back. I wouldn't blame him for that. I wouldn't want to follow ARCA. But whatever the reason, Welcher and the other rebuttal witnesses are out, and the case is finally coming to a close. The attorneys spend the majority of the trial introducing evidence for the jury to consider through witnesses and exhibits, but they're actually only allowed to address the jury directly twice during each trial. Once during opening statements, where they introduce the case and explain what they say the evidence will show, and once during closing arguments, where they attempt to persuade the jury to adopt their interpretation of the facts by tying together their narrative of the case with key testimony and evidence. Each side was given an hour and 15 minutes to do this, and since the prosecution has the burden of proof, they get the last word. So first up, arguing for the defense, was attorney Alan Jackson. Jackson started out with the main thing that he wants the jury to focus on.
There was no collision. There was no collision. There was no collision.
If you remember, this is a line that he used during his opening statements. He said the jury is staring directly at injustice, and they are the last line of defense in a case that was corrupted from the start. These are powerful words. Jackson spent a good amount of time talking about Proctor, the disgusting text he sent, and that he was fired for misconduct in this case. And all of the evidence that the Commonwealth is relying on, he says that it all went through Proctor's hands. He discussed Higgins as a potential suspect and said there was no blood or tissue on the taillight pieces, and the injuries on John's arm were from a dog. He brought up the various investigation issues, like how no one went in 34 Fairview, no one checked the neighbors' houses for ring footage, and no one looked into Lucky the snowplow driver's report of a Ford Edge being parked in front of the house. And he reminded the jurors that the Commonwealth's own medical expert wouldn't even label John's death a homicide. But to me, the most important part of Jackson's closings were his passionate statements about reasonable doubt and moral certainty. He told the jury that moral certainty means a person is certain about the entirety of the Commonwealth's case. If the thought is, well, she's likely guilty, or she's probably guilty, that is not enough to meet that standard. He told the jury to ask themselves if they could convict Karen Reed, would they ever be able to say to themselves, this is justice. Goosebumps. Jackson closed by telling the jurors to find Karen Reed not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. Brennan began his closing by talking about John and that he spent his life helping people. He was a law enforcement officer, helped his community, and became the legal guardian of his niece and nephew after his sister and brother-in-law tragically passed away. Brennan said that on January 29, 2022, John was the one who needed help, and that Karen left him to die. He focused on how much Karen had to drink that night, and that John and Karen's relationship was toxic and crumbling. What I found odd is how often Brennan brought up Jen McCabe and referred to her as John O'Keefe's best friend. Why would he do that? She was rarely mentioned by the defense, and we've never even seen a picture of the two of them together. Brennan also took digs at ARCA, bringing up the deleted text, Dr. Wolf using Signal, and the lower weight dummy arm.
Wasn't trying to bash him, wasn't trying to insult him, tried to get him just to recognize that a 9.38 pound arm is less weight than John O'Keefe's metric, which would be 11.8. That's all, and because it's a lighter arm, it takes more speed to create the same damage. I don't know science, I don't know math very well, but
but that's basic. It's basic. And he fought me over and over again. Did he seem objective that he was trying to help you? Because Dr. Renshaw came in the next day and said, well, you have to adjust for that. That's all I asked him for an hour about adjusting, just like Judge Welcher adjusted. Do you adjust it? And he tried to talk to me like I was making something up. His own colleague had to admit it.
No surprise that this is a complete misrepresentation. Here's what Renshaw actually said about Dr. Wolf needing to adjust it.
Did you know that when Dr. Wolf did his tests using the hybrid pre-dummy, he didn't make any adjustments?
What do you mean? What adjustments would he make? You get the acceleration, but the acceleration's not going to change, and that's what we utilize. Then you can scale the weight of the body, but I'm not sure what he would have made adjustments for.
Brennan also played some of Karen's angry voicemails and afterward made a misleading statement to the jury.
And then she leaves at 5:07. She gets to Jen McCabe's about, 5:35, 28 minutes. It's about a 10-minute ride. Where does she go in 28 minutes? Where does she go? We don't know. We don't have data for that.
The reason this is misleading is because it's not true. We do have some of the data of where she was during that time. We know that she went to the waterfall first, looking for John. Then we know that she turned from the waterfall and went toward Jen McCabe's house. She's on video, turning right at like 5:18 or 5:19 and going towards Jen's house. If she had gone to 34 Fairview, then she likely would have hit on the cell phone towers that are there. And she didn't. She only hit on the cell phone towers that are by Jen McCabe's house. And we know that when she's at 34 Fairview, she uses those towers that are closer to there. Because when she got there at 6 o'clock, those are the towers that her phone was using. And when she was there the night before, those are the towers her phone was using. Plus, Brennan said that she got to Jen McCabe's at 5:35, but Jen McCabe testified that she got there between 5:20 and 5:30. So that 28-minute window is really only a window of about 2 to 12 minutes for about a 4 or 5-minute drive. Very misleading. In the end, Brennan told the jurors that they have a difficult job to do and that Karen left a kind and generous man alone to die. With each side having done everything they can do, the case is now ready to be handed over to the jury, putting the fate of Karen Reed in the hands of 12 of her peers. There were a few last-minute changes to the jury instructions, including the defense withdrawing their request for a missing witness instruction, which was actually surprising. The missing witness instruction allows the jury to infer that the prosecution not calling Proctor means that Proctor's testimony would have been unfavorable to them. The defense also asked that the verdict form be made clearer and less confusing, but Judge Cannone denied that request. The jury is now deliberating for 3 separate counts, one of which has lesser included charges. And there was a surprising change to the charges this year, which I'll explain. The first count is second degree murder. For the jury to find Karen guilty of this, they have to unanimously all agree that she caused John's death by intentionally gunning it in reverse toward him, disregarding that there would be a strong likelihood of death or serious bodily harm. She didn't have to have intent to kill him, only intent to do an act that she knows could likely kill him. This is a mandatory life sentence with the possibility of parole after 15 years. The second count is manslaughter while operating a vehicle under the influence. This is the charge that has the lesser included charges, meaning maybe the jury doesn't think that this was proven, but maybe they believe parts of it were proven. This is the one that the jury says they were hung up on in the last trial. And this year, there's a new lesser included charge added. The least confusing example I can give of how this works is armed robbery. If a person is charged with armed robbery, and during the trial, they were able to prove that he robbed the place, but never able to prove that he had a weapon, then he would be found not guilty of armed robbery because he doesn't meet all of the elements. A lesser included may be just robbery. So the jury would move down the verdict form to that next option, and that one would be guilty. But if they weren't able to prove robbery either, then it would be not guilty on all. So the first part of this is the manslaughter while driving under the influence. The jury would have to unanimously agree that Karen caused John's death by driving intoxicated and recklessly, ignoring that her driving created a high likelihood of danger. It would mean that she didn't mean to kill him, but she meant to drive backward toward him at a high rate in those conditions and put him in danger. This can carry a sentence of 5 to 20 years. If the jury doesn't think that that was proven, then they move on to the first lesser included charge, involuntary manslaughter. Now, this is the same thing as the last, but without the driving drunk part. There's no specified minimum sentence for this one, but it can also be up to 20 years. Now, if the jury doesn't agree with that one, then they move on to the next. Motor vehicle homicide while operating under the influence. This would mean that they unanimously agree that Karen drove intoxicated and her negligent operation, which a reasonable person wouldn't have done, caused John's death. This one carries a sentence of 1 to 15 years. And the final lesser included is the new addition this year. It's simply driving under the influence. Now, if they don't think any of the others were proven, but they think that the prosecution proved she drove drunk, they can convict her of just that. A first offense OUI in Massachusetts rarely results in time behind bars, but Judge Cannoni could sentence her up to 2.5 years. Based on juror interviews from the first trial, it seems like there was some deliberation discussion about how Karen was driving drunk and John was there, so maybe that's what happened and they should convict on something like that. Now, FYI, that's not how the law works, but I do understand that jurors can be confused about some of these things. Beyond a reasonable doubt is a very high standard. And if a juror believes that she maybe did or more than likely did or even probably did it, that doesn't count. That's a not guilty verdict. But having this option may help some of those jurors in that position to feel like they're still holding the defendant accountable for something, even when the burden of proof for the collision wasn't met. They know she drove, and although there was testimony that she didn't seem intoxicated, she admitted in one of the interview clips that she was buzzed and shouldn't have been driving. I truly believe that if there is a justifiable conviction for anything in this case, it would be this one solely because of her own admission in that clip. The final count is leaving the scene of an accident resulting in death. This would mean that the jury unanimously agrees that she hit John and left him to avoid getting in trouble for it. The sentence for that could be anywhere from 1 year in jail up to 10 years in state prison. It's hard to imagine what the friends and family who loved John O'Keefe must be going through on a daily basis. They have faced an immense and ongoing struggle in the wake of his tragic death, trying to process their loss amid prolonged legal proceedings and intense public scrutiny. My heart breaks for victims and their loved ones in every case I cover. And while honoring and respecting the victim is always going to be an important part of how I share these stories with you, the primary purpose of a criminal trial is to determine if the prosecution can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant who has been charged is in fact guilty. Evidence is weighed, testimony is discussed, theories are debated, and credibility is determined. The trials where the burden of proof was easily met tend to give me a little more peace toward the end. After hearing all of the evidence, when I know beyond a reasonable doubt that they have the right person being held accountable, I feel confident and hopeful, knowing that the justice system worked and the jury's decision will close this chapter so that the family can begin the process of healing. But cases like the death of Officer John O'Keefe and the trial of Karen Reed don't give me that same peace. I don't feel confident that they're holding the right person accountable. I don't have faith in how the justice system is working right now. And I don't feel hopeful knowing that this chapter may be coming to a close. I truly in my heart believe that the only just verdict based on the evidence presented is not guilty. But I'm also aware of how painful that verdict would be for John's loved ones. On the other hand, A guilty verdict may provide them with the ability to put some of this behind them and start the next chapter of healing, but at what cost? If the wrong person is behind bars, that's not justice. A wrongful conviction undermines the very principles that the legal system is meant to uphold. It's a betrayal of the idea that the justice system exists to seek truth and protect the innocent. I can't even begin to think about another mistrial and having to do this over again for a third time. So, what outcome would actually bring peace? I don't think there is one. I can't help but think about what Karen must be thinking each day as she enters the courtroom while the jury is deliberating. Every morning, getting dressed, not knowing what the future holds. Maybe she leaves that morning and comes back a free woman with all of this finally behind her. Maybe she leaves that morning and never comes home. With Karen's fate now in the hands of 12 strangers, the gravity of the situation hangs heavy in the air as we all wait to find out what happens next. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.